of the Minneapolis police. The party is over. We can, if you all just grab your stuff and leave, there won't be any hassle. The party's been closed. The party is over with. Grab your stuff and go, and then nobody goes to jail.
Dial GFC 90.7 FM. Eastern Hudson, Patsdale.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Acra or anytime at WGXC.org.
Are you tired of your flying saucer always breaking down on your way to Mars?
Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Acra or anytime at WGXC.org.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, Happy New Year. It's not the Chinese New Year, but it's New Year's. So, like all good Abrahamic religion people, that's what we say. I wish I could make my little fireworks go off like on my phone, but that's not happening tonight because, it's New Year's. And if one of us is guilty, all of us are guilty. I'm going to read a couple of crime stories. The first one is by Chester Himes. It's from his omnibus collection, The Collected Stories of Chester Himes. I think it's Picador. No, it's Thunder's Mouth Press. I don't know when he wrote this story, but it's a good one. It's called One More Way to Die. Let me adjust my microphone and you can adjust your radio. Okay. Excuse me for that technical difficulty. Here we go. One More Way to Die by Chester Himes. When I got off work at the cannery, I went home and washed the slop off my hands and face, washed under my arms, and then changed from my overalls to a slack suit. I got my money out of the tin can back of the stove where I kept it hid and counted it. I had 18 bucks and some change. I went out and walked up Long Beach to Jose's at the corner of 40th and bought a quart of beer. Jose wiped the bar with a dirty rag, then wiped the sweat off his face with the same rag and said, "You owe me 35 cents from yesterday." "I'll pay you mañana," I said. "Always mañana, mañana." He beefed and spit in the sink. "Hey, don't spit in the sink where you wash the glasses," some patty down the bar said. Jose shrugged. "It's all the same," he said. I beat at the flies and drank my beer. It made me sweat like a son of a gun. "That Spanish kid," another patty spoke up. "Spit where you please, Spanish." Jose wiped his face with a dirty rag and gave the patty a sidewise look. There was three patties and a couple of Mexes and two other spooks scattered along the bar. Some Pachuco kids was ganged up about the jukebox, talking in Mex and blowing weed, and a couple of beat-up colored mamas sat in the window booth waiting for chumps. In the next booth, a big snuff-dipping mama had her two slaving studs in overalls, and the booth in back had a couple of Mexes from old Mexico drinking Muscatel. When I finished my second quart, I had to go. I went out in the alley at the side. Then I went back and I said, "Give me another quart. Let's fill it up again." Two old beat-up high yellow biddies came in with a big yellow stud called Sweet Wine, who went for bad. They sat down beside me. Sweet Wine leaned on my shoulder and said, "Buy us some beer, Tar Baby." I didn't like this stud, and I didn't like to be called Tar Baby. Brown is my name, but I didn't have my blade, so I just said, "Here, you can have some of what I got," shoving him the bottle. He picked it up and drank it dry and set it down. "Now ain't that something," one of the old biddies said to the other. "Ain't offered you or me a drop." She turned to me. "You'll buy us a little beer, won't you, mister?" Sweet Wine said, "Sure. This nigga'll buy us a drink. He got everything, working at the cannery, making all that gold. Come on, Tar Baby, set us up." I knew he was looking for trouble. "Four wines," I said to Jose. I had to break a five to pay him. The biddy next to me leaned over and said, "Come on, let's you and me have some fun." The other old biddy giggled. I said, "What's the matter with the fun you already got?" "That nigga done gone," she said. The other old biddy giggled again. I looked around and sure enough, Sweet Wine had slipped out. I would have known that old yellow hag didn't want nobody black as me, but I said, "Anyway, come on down to my pad." We had no more got outside by the alley when she grabbed me from behind, and Sweet Wine come out the alley and cold cocked me. When I come to, the Pachucos had me halfway up the alley, rolling me. I turned over, braced my hands against the ground, and pushed my knees. Then I got to my feet. My jaw felt numb. I fingered it lightly, moved it from side to side to see if it was broke. Then I said to the Pachucos, "Give me back my dough." One of them laughed. "Sweet Wine cleans you before he turns you out." "He sure clipped you," another said. I fanned myself anyway, just to be sure, but I was bare. "Which way they go?" I said. Pachuco shrugged. I started home to get my blade to look for him and run into a police cruiser down at Vernon. "Hey," I called, "wait a minute, I've been robbed." The young cop driving backed over to the curb and said, "Come here, boy." I came over by the car, and he and the other cop, an older man with gray hair and a sergeant's stripes, looked me up and down. "Who robbed you?" the young cop asked. "Fella called Sweet Wine," I said. "He and some woman who was with him." "Where'd they rob you?" "Down by the alley right next to Joe's. Jose's, I mean." He sniffed my breath. "Drunk, eh? They rolled, eh?" "No, sir. I was in Jose's drinking beer and wasn't bothering nobody when they come in and want me to buy him a drink. I bought him a drink just to keep from having trouble. Then Sweet Wine, he left. Then after a while, me and the woman come out and..." "Oh, you was with the woman," he cut in. "No, sir. I just come out with her. Sweet Wine, he was with her. I just come out on the street with her. Then she grabbed me and he cold cocked me. When I come to..." "What's your name, boy?" he cut in again. "Brown," I said, "William Brown." "What do they call you?" "Well, some calls me Tar Baby, but most just calls me Brown by my name."
"You ain't that Tar Baby what stabbed that sailor up here a couple nights ago, are you?"
he asked. "No, sir. I ain't been up here a couple nights ago. I work at the cannery," I told him. Sergeant said, "I know a dinge in Kansas City called Ruckus Fuckus.
We picked up a boy the other night called White Baby," the young cop said. "He was black as my shoe.
They laughed a little. Then the young cop jumped out the car and shook me down. When he didn't find anything, he said,
"Where's that knife, boy?"
"I don't carry no knife," I said. He got back in the car and started the motor. The sergeant said, "Better go home, boy. We'll find sweet wine and get your money. How much was it you said he took?" "About $15. I went home and got my knife and put it in my pocket and went back to Jose's. Sweet wine and the woman hadn't come back. I walked down Long Beach to the Cove at 36. They wasn't there either. I cut across to Ascot, stopped in two or three joints along the way, and I turned back out toward Vernon. It was about 11 o'clock when I found him out at the Dewdrop Inn at Biddy First and Hooper. I saw the old hag sitting at the bar guzzling juice, but I didn't see sweet wine. Next to her, a guy was drinking a quart of beer. The bar was full up. All the booths along the wall was full. There was a lot of people standing around. I went in, picked up the quart bottle the guy had next to her, and broke it across her head. She staggered up, snapped open the switchblade, slashed at me. I jumped back and popped open my blade and cut her on the arm. Sweet wine come from somewhere behind me and hit me across the head with a chair. I fell forward onto the bar, buttoned her back into the jukebox. I went down on my hands and knees, but I turned and crawled between somebody's legs before she got herself set. People was running all around, trying to get out the way, so neither of us could get to the other. Sweet wine got over to one side of me, reached around behind a guy and hit me with the chair again. Somebody kicked me on the side of the face, trying to get out the way. I got between somebody's legs and cut sweet wine on the leg. I just reached around the back part of his leg and pulled my shiv forward like I was chopping down sugar cane. He kicked me in the mouth and I stabbed him in the thigh. People was all running out in the street, screaming and cussing. The old hag run up and stabbed me in the neck. I jumped to my feet and began slashing out, right and left, cutting at everybody. What people was left run over each other trying to get out the way. I moved around, getting both her and sweet wine in front of me. Then I jumped at him and slashed as fast as I could move my arm. I didn't cut neither one of them. The old hag run toward me, slashing back and forth like I was. She didn't cut me neither, but she made me back up. I kept on backing up until I backed into something. I looked around and saw cases of pop bottles stacked against the wall. I slashed at her real fast till she backed up a little. Then I stuck my knife in my pocket and started chunking bottles. First one popped sweet wine square in the forehead, bust the skin wide open. Next one caught him in the mouth and bust his lips. Woman was running around trying to get behind the bar to chunk some wine bottles, and the bartender was trying to stop her. Arm was bloody where I had cut her, and she bled all over the floor. Sweet wine turned and tried to run, but his leg was cut so bad all he could do was hobble. I bust him a couple of times in the back, but I was chucking bottles so fast I couldn't see where they was going. Then all of a sudden I heard somebody scream,
"He bit me! He hit me with a bottle!"
I looked it up and saw an old white woman standing in the door with blood coming out of her head. Everybody knew her. She was an old wino, used to come there every night, get juiced up. Lived somewhere close by. But when we saw her standing there with the blood coming out of her head, everybody stopped and just gaped at her. We quit fighting, just stood there. I was scared maybe I'd killed her. And she a white woman too. She started cussing everybody out. Then the police came. There was two young guys this time. They held all four of us there waiting for the ambulance and the paddy wagon, and they kept gritting their teeth and looking at me.
"This the nigga what hit you, ma'am?"
one of them asked the old white lady, grabbing me by the collar.
"That's the dirty black bastard," she screamed, "hit me with a pop bottle."
"I didn't go to hit you, lady," I said. I was scared as hell. "I wasn't chunking at you, lady. I was chunking at these people what robbed." The cop drew back and hit me in the stomach. Then he hit me in the mouth.
"Shut up, you black son of a bitch," he said. "God damn you, we kill niggas for hitting white women in Texas."
People was coming back into the joint and they was crowding all about, looking at us, but wasn't nobody saying nothing. They just stood there looking black and evil and wondering what the cops was gonna do to me. "I didn't go to hit a cap," I said, "honest to God."
"Well, God damn you, you black bastard, what you hit it for?"
the other cop asked. She just happened to come in, Cap. You know I wasn't chunking at no white.
God damn you, don't you say nothing when you talk back to me,
he said. Well, yes, sir.
If I had you in Texas, the first cop began.
By this time, the ambulance drove up. They put the white woman in on the stretchers. The other woman sat there on the back on a chair. Then they looked at me and Sweet Wine. They wrapped a string or something around Sweet Wine's leg and drew it tight and said it'd be all right to bring him down in the paddy wagon. When they started to look at me, one of the cops said,
we'll bring this nigger in. He ain't hurt.
The other cop said, yet. I'm stabbed in the back, I began. First cop hit me in the mouth again. When the paddy wagon came, they put Sweet Wine in it and drove up. Then they took me out to the cruiser and put me in the back seat with one of the cops sitting next to me. Well, where y'all taking me, Cap? I asked. Y'all ain't gonna beat me, is you, Cap?
Shut up, you black son of a bitch, the cop said,
and he hit me across the mouth with his pistol butt. I didn't say no more. They turned up burning the Long Beach, kept downtown till they come to where the railroad tracks split off. Then they drove up a dark alley beside a scrap iron boundary, and the cop told me to get out. Oh, Captain, you oughtn't to whip me, I began. I was hurt, Cap. He grabbed me by the collar and jerked me out on the ground. I lay there just like I fell, scared to move. The other cop got out, come around the car. One of them shot me. My stomach went hollow. My chest seemed to cave in. I was so scared I couldn't hardly breathe. Y'all ain't gonna shoot me, is he, Cap? I begged. One of the cops laughed.
What's he think we're doing now? This is what we do with niggas in Texas, the other one said,
and he shot me square through the stomach. Captain, y'all ain't gonna kill me, I cried. They stood there looking down at me, grinning. One of them spit on me. Then the whole sky began to spin around and around, and the telegraph poles along Long Beach began shimmying like they was alive. Then everything began to go away. I kept looking at the two cops, looking at their faces until they was just blurred and white, and I couldn't hardly make them out at all. I was begging them over and over again. Captain, please don't kill me. Please, Captain. I swear I'll never hit another white woman as long as I live, not even by mistake. I knew my lips was moving, but I couldn't even hear my own voice. I heard the first cop say, let's get it over with. Then I heard the sound of the shot, and I felt the bullet go right through my chest. I couldn't even see nothing at all. I felt myself leaking all inside. It was just like a kettle on the stove and began running over. But I didn't hurt much. I was just going on away. Last thing I heard was a whole lot of shots real fast, and I could feel all the bullets going through me. But they didn't hurt at all. It was just like a guy sticking a fork in soft butter. Like a guy jabbing an ice pick into a piece of fresh killed meat. Last thing I thought as I lay there on the goddamn ground and died was it just ain't no goddamn sense in you white folks killing me. That was Chester Hines. From Collected Stories of Chester Himes on Thunder's Mouth Press. Late, great Chester Himes, one of my favorites. They made some of his crazy stories into movies even. Was that one with Robin Givens? I can't remember. One More Way to Die. That was the name of that story. I'm going to switch to a different writer here. This is a book called short stories by Helen Nielsen. It's called Turning the Tables, the short stories of Helen Nielsen. These stories were published between 57 and 91, about the time that Chester Himes was writing. I think he actually finished in 84. Maybe he's about 10 years earlier, maybe more like 47 to 81. Anyways, this is a collection, like I said, called Turning the Tables, the Short Stories of Helen Nielsen. And this story is called Cops Day Off. Sam Ward had worked for the detective lieutenant's badge in his pocket, and he never stopped working. That was the mystery around headquarters. What made Sammy run so hard? He didn't seem particularly ambitious. He wasn't prodding Captain Norton for his job or aspiring to a place on the DA's staff, and he'd never been a glory boy looking for headlines. He was just a cop who worked hard. He never stopped. He never relaxed. He seldom smiled. "Sam," Captain Norton said, "what are you doing here today? Isn't this supposed to be your day off?" Sam, who was 36 but appeared older because of the pinched lines about his eyes and mouth, looked up from his desk with an almost guilty cringe. "I'm just running through some of the unsolved files," he said. "Well, stop running through them," the captain snapped. "You look terrible. You got bags under your eyes and your skin's the color of old library paste. I want you out of here. Ray, take Sam with you." Ray Moreno had the same kind of badge in his pocket, but he'd come by it with less strain. His face could still smile, wide, with the white teeth flashing. "I'm meeting my wife at the airport, Captain. She's coming in from Mexico City." "Okay, so take Sam down to meet your wife, or drop him off at the ballpark. Do something. I'm getting tired of seeing him in here every day. You'd think a married man might at least have a lawn to mow." When the captain was in that kind of mood, there was only one thing to do about it. Sam got up from his desk and followed Moreno outside. It was a nice day, clear, no haze, with a fair wind blowing in off the ocean that would grow stronger as they drove south.
Don't let the captain burn you," Moreno said. "He rides me too, but this time he's right. The taxpayers aren't going to remember you if you kill yourself on the job. Taxpayers aren't going to remember you any day any longer if you kill yourself on the job." Sam stared out of the window and said nothing. It was the best way he knew to change the subject of an unwanted conversation, and it worked. Moreno continued. "I know what I'm going to find at that airport, a basket full of bottles. Every time my wife flies down to visit her family, she comes back with another one of those hand-woven baskets full of bottles from the glass-blowing factory. Blue bottles, brown bottles, purple bottles. The house is so full of them now that I've been threatening to add another wing. Does your wife collect anything, Sam?"
There was the old standard reply, "Nothing but my paycheck," but Sam didn't give in. "No," he said, "she doesn't."
"You're a lucky man," Moreno said. "When a woman gets started collecting something, there's just no... Hey, what's going on up there? Looks like somebody's hurt."
Moreno disliked the freeway. He turned off on a side street, one of the numerous shortcuts he knew so well. Now, sliding up over a small rise, they were suddenly in the midst of a mob scene in the middle of the street. Moreno touched the siren button to clear a passage and wheeled the sedan to the curb. By this time, they could see a tiny form lying in the street. Moreno had his door open before he cut the motor. Even so, Sam beat him to the spot. The victim was a child, a 7 or 8 year old girl. She'd been struck down by an auto. That was obvious even before the volunteered information erupted from the spectators. She was unconscious. No visible wounds, but possible internal injuries. Kneeling beside the child, a panic-stricken woman clenched her own hands together to keep them from reaching out to the victim.
"Don't move up," somebody called from the crowd. "She may have a broken neck."
"Oh, Kathy,"
Moreno knelt beside the woman. "That's right, lady," he said. "You mustn't move her. Has anyone called for an ambulance?"
"I did," a man said.
The voice was deep and commanding. Sam, who now stood beside Moreno, was forced to turn his eyes away from the child. It was an old man who had spoken the words, tall, white-haired, majestic in appearance. He wore a loose-fitting sweater coat, baggy trousers, and heavy felt slippers on his feet, but there was an authority about him that commanded instant attention.
"I called for the ambulance and the police as soon as I saw it happen," he said. "You came a lot faster than I expected."
We didn't come in answer to the call, Marino explained. We were just passing by.
Well, that explains it, the man said. I'm getting too old to stand the shock of seeing the public served by its employees.
Marino stood up. The public's employees are spread pretty thin in a growing city, he said. He whipped out a notebook and a pencil. What's your name, sir? He asked. The old man lost the shade of majesty.
Just because I made a remark about public employees.
Forget it, Marino said. Everybody makes remarks about public employees. We'd feel neglected if they didn't. I want your name because you said that you saw what happened here.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir, I did. My name's Max Schiller. I live right across the street. That's my house with the rocker on the front porch. Ask anyone around here. They'll tell you who I am.
With a murmur of assent behind him, Marino made note of Schiller's name and address.
And you, lady?
When the woman who had knelt beside the child tried to rise, Sam stepped forward and helped her to her feet. She was light, a small woman and young, not over 25, Sam guessed. She trembled slightly against his arm.
Sally Grossman, she said. I live here.
She nodded at the house behind Marino's shoulder.
But Kathy isn't my child. She's Kathy Lambert. She lives down in the corner house. Her parents are divorced. Her mother works. Kathy ran out into the street after Susie. That's her cat, her Siamese cat.
Suddenly fear leaped into her eyes.
Bobby, she called. Where's Bobby?
I'm here, Mom.
The boy wriggled through the crowd to reach his mother. He was probably 10. Thin and awkward in his t-shirt and denims, the woman's hands grasped his shoulders protectively, and he grinned in disgust.
I came out to call Bobby, Mrs. Grossman continued, and I saw Kathy up the street playing with her cat. She's such a sweet girl and alone so much. The cat's a companion to her. Then, all of a sudden, Susie jumped out of Kathy's arms and darted across the street. I think Kathy must have seen the car coming and was afraid for Susie. She ran after her. I screamed, and Kathy went down in front of the car. I think I screamed.
The woman looked about for confirmation.
Somebody screamed. I think it was me.
What kind of car was it? Marino asked.
Car? Mrs. Grossman seemed helpless.
A 59 Impala convertible, Bobby Grossman announced loudly.
Pale blue. Bobby, be quiet, his mother ordered. That's all he talks about, officer. He wants his father to buy a blue Impala convertible. As far as the car that struck Kathy, I don't know. It happened so fast, and all I could think of was the child.
The driver didn't stop.
Oh, no, that's what makes it all so horrible. The car just kept right on going.
Marino turned to Max Schiller, who stood all this time like a prophet waiting to be called for testimony. Before the question could be asked, he said, it was a sedan, a big gray sedan, a Buick, not a new one, 6, 7 years old, maybe. I sat there on the porch across the street and watched him come up over the rise. He never slacked speed, never thought about a child playing in the street.
He? Marino echoed. Are you sure it was a man?
Look, Schiller said, do you see that delivery truck backing out of the driveway 3 doors down? What's the lettering on the side of it? Marino was puzzled. Sam followed the direction of his gaze. The truck was pulling out of the driveway, but it was old and unwashed. The lettering was indistinct. Ralph's TV Repair Service, the old man read aloud. Call MA6078. Oops, there he goes, and I missed the last number. And that's without glasses. 72 years old and no glasses. Ask anyone around here.
That's true, Mrs. Grossman volunteered. Mr. Schiller reads the finest print. The Bible, even, without glasses. If he says it was a Buick.
It was an Impala, Bobby protested.
A gray Buick, Schiller repeated, driven by a man, a young man. They think of nothing but themselves, these young men. They don't see, care how many children they kill. The sound of the ambulance siren cut off Schiller's commentary. The crowd fanned out and flattened against the curb. Grim men. Grim work to do. Moments later, a police car arrived. By this time, Marino had the story organized. They could get out an immediate alert for a gray Buick sedan, 6 or 7 years old, driven by a young man. It would show signs of an accident. The impact had been hard. There were fragments of glass on the street. Moreno was ready to continue to the airport. "Go ahead," Sam said. "I'm too late for the ball game now. I'll go back in the other car." "Captain won't be happy to see you," Moreno cautioned. "Well, he can look the other way," Sam answered. Moreno drove away, and Sam waited on the curb until the ambulance had gone. Questioning over, old Max Schiller ambled across the street and sat down in his rocking chair. He looked like a white-crowned eagle on self-imposed sentry duty over the street. Mrs. Grossman, Bobby in tow, started back to her own house. "Does he always sit like that?" Sam asked. "Mr. Schiller?" The woman paused and looked back over her shoulder. "Yes, most of the time," she said.
"Ever since Johnny ran off with that old woman," Bobby piped. "Bobby, you get into the house this instant. Scoot, now."
A slap on the rear sent Bobby on his way, but not soon enough. "Johnny?" Sam repeated. "Who's Johnny?" "Old Mr. Schiller's grandson." "And he ran away?" "Yeah, about 4 months ago. He'd been keeping company with an older woman. It upset the old man. Naturally, Johnny's parents were killed when he was a child. Johnny was all Mr. Schiller had." "So that's why he sits on the front porch?" Sam mused. "Johnny." It was all in a missing persons file, among the unclosed cases. John Schiller, 20, white, dark brown hair, gray eyes, height 5'9", weight 140. Distinguishing marks: anchor and coiled serpent tattooed on right forearm. Believed to have eloped with Sandy Downs, sometimes known as Andrea Dawn, entertainer. Schiller has served one hitch in the Navy, radio technician. Has worked as drummer in nightclubs, gas station attendant, radio repairman. Believed to have gone to Las Vegas. The report was accompanied by a photograph of a dark-haired, good-looking young man in the uniform of an apprentice seaman. In spite of his youth, John Schiller had very solemn, searching eyes. A woman would consider them romantic. That was all. There was no indication of any investigation or subsequent reports. The case was dated nearly 6 months past. Mrs. Grossman had been a little off in her memory. Sam Ward studied the file for a few minutes and then went to Captain Norton.
"I thought I told you to go to a ball game," Norton admonished.
"I was with Moreno when he came across the hit and run," Sam explained, "a Lambert girl." Norton's face darkened. "I just heard from the hospital. She's in a critical condition. If she dies, it means a manslaughter charge against the young man driving a gray Buick sedan," Sam said. It was the way he said it that caused Norton to look at him in a listening way. Sam Ward wasn't a great talker. When he did talk, it meant that something was on his mind.
"What do you want?" Norton asked.
Sam handed him the file. "I want to look for John Schiller," he said.
"Any particular reason?"
Sam hesitated. "Call it a hunch," he said.
"All right," Norton sighed. "If that's what you'd rather do than go to a ball game, go ahead. It's your day off."
The trouble with missing persons cases was that there were so many of them. Too many. If John Schiller had been a minor teenage girl, for example, more of a search would have been made. But he wasn't a minor, and he'd committed no crime except to break an old man's heart. In this case, a call to the Las Vegas police for a check of the marriage mills would have covered the situation. But when a grown man and woman went off together, it didn't necessarily mean Las Vegas. One thing was certain. In nearly 6 months' time, two people had to eat. John Schiller hadn't come from a fashionable neighborhood. There was no reason to believe he'd gone off with a bankroll. And who was this Sandy Downs or Andrea Dawn?
an entertainer, the report said, but no one Sam had ever heard of. Entertainers weren't exactly a scarcity in Los Angeles, but if an entertainer worked, she had to be registered somewhere. Sam spent the next half hour on the telephone and came up with the information that Sandy Downs, a singer, had last been booked at the Blue Pussycat, a nightclub in Santa Monica. Sam put on his hat and started traveling. The Blue Pussycat was as uninviting in mid-afternoon as any similar establishment. It was a place designed for the lower echelon trade. The bar was open, but deserted, except for a bartender. And one customer who appeared to be a permanent fixture. Sam flashed his badge and was directed to the owner, who was in his office with his tax accountant. "My master," the owner explained. "In the old days, Lieutenant, a man with no education except from the school of hard knocks could take a few dollars plus a lot of guts and make out in this world, but those days are gone forever. Sit down and have a cigar, Lieutenant. And Roger, be sure and make a note. One cigar in the deductions for goodwill." Roger was a neatly dressed young man with an Ivy League haircut and heavy black-rimmed glasses. He seemed completely humorless. By contrast, the owner, whose name was Mike Adamic, was in shirt sleeves, had no hair except a gray shadow circling above his ears, and laughed as easily as a man who's about to lose his last dollar. When Sam stated his mission, Adamic's forced joviality faded. "Sandy," he said, "sure, I remember her. I booked Sandy in and out ever since she was a kid. She had plenty of spark in those days. This last engagement was pitiful. I wanted to cancel after the first week, but what can you do? If I didn't have such a big heart, Roger wouldn't have me handcuffed. I let her stay the full 6 weeks, just for old time's sake." "And when was that?" Sam asked. Adamic turned to Roger. "Tell the lieutenant when," he said. "Last name?" Roger queried. Adamic grinned up at Sam. "You see, he's just like Univac. The last name, Roger, is Downs. Sandy Downs." Roger picked up a ledger from the stack on the desk and thumbed through it until his index finger came to rest under a certain notation. "Downs, Sandy," he read aloud. "April 7, 59 through May 12, 59. Salary, $200 per week. Total paid out, $1,200, less federal income tax and unemployment insurance." "Beautiful," Adamic said. "April to May," Sam mused. "That makes it almost 6 months since she terminated. Tell me, Mr. Adamic, was Miss Downs keeping company with anyone at the time she worked here?" Adamic raised his eyebrows. "Lieutenant, I'm not a chaperone," he began. But by this time, Sam had pulled the photograph of John Schiller out of his coat pocket, and at the sight of it, Adamic's expression changed. "Sure, I remember that kid," he said. "Johnny something or other. What's wrong, Lieutenant? Is he in trouble?" "I wouldn't be surprised," Sam said. He stayed just long enough to get Sandy Downs' address when she was employed at the Blue Pussycat, plus a publicity still which showed what happened to a once lovely blonde who had stood under the spotlights and listened to the loud music a little too long. Her smile already had a trace of hardness, and the retoucher couldn't take the disillusionment out of her eyes. She was at the stage where she needed the love of youth, and John Schiller was an orphan, looking for his mother. The address was that of a fashionable apartment. Apartment hotel fronting on the
mounting on the ocean. And the story was surely to pay off no for mounting chiefly of her brother was the manager couldn't address either. Her brother, Sam brought out the photo of John Schiller and handed it to the manager. Yep, that's the young man. Nice looking. But you can't tell by faces, can you? You can't tell by faces, Sam agreed. As Sam prepared to leave the building, the afternoon papers were delivered to the foyer. He paused to read the front page. The Kathy Lambert story was in it. Her condition was still critical. She had yet to regain consciousness. The police were searching for a gray Buick sedan as described by an eyewitness. Sam scanned the story quickly and put the paper aside. He was still searching for two people who had to eat. Microdomics Human Univac had noted two deductions from Sandy Down's salary. The federal government didn't give out information, but the California Department of Employment was more cooperative. Sam consulted a telephone directory for the location of the local branch and continued his search. Beyond the multiple lines of weary humanity edging toward the cashier's windows were offices, and inside one of the offices was another human univac. Sam was struck by how little they differed from one another in appearance, who in due time divulged that the department had no Sandy Downs listed among its clientele. But it did have an Andrea Dawn. Is she currently collecting? Sam asked. Currently, he was told, but not for long. She has only 3 weeks' compensation still due her. And when does she receive the next payment? Are you familiar with Miss Downs or Downs' appearance, Lieutenant? I have her photograph, Sam said. Then if you're not too late or she's not too early, you should be able to spot her in the lineup at window 4. I'll check with the cashier. Sam didn't wait for more. Outside the office, the lines of worried humanity now became individuals with faces and bodies. Sometimes luck was with you, sometimes it wasn't. It hadn't been with Kathy Lambert, but it was with Sam when he took a spectator's position in view of window 4. It was getting late in the afternoon. The line was short. He hadn't long to wait before a tall, blonde woman marched through the front doors and headed toward the window. Even without the publicity photo, he would have recognized Sandy Downs. Faded she might be, but she still made the others in the room look dowdy by comparison. Her capri pants were skin tight, her blouse was blazing red, and her blonde head tossed back like a startled coat when he stepped forward and called her by name. Ms. Downs. She didn't speak. She gave him one penetrating stare and reached an immediate decision. The decision was to leave. Suddenly. She wheeled past him and hurried toward the side exit. The few seconds and timing that her move cost Sam were enough. By the time he reached the street, she was climbing into a car waiting at the curb. He caught a glimpse of the blazing red blouse before the vehicle swung out into traffic. A man was driving, and for a moment Sam saw his face clearly. It was John Schiller, and the car he drove was an old gray Buick sedan. Moreno was back from the airport. What do you know? He was saying, no bottles this trip. This trip, my wife brought back a bongo drum, a 4-foot-high bongo drum. When my teenage boy comes home and sees that, wow, I don't think I dare go home. Moreno, Captain Norton's voice broke up Moreno's tale. He had a message. Sam Ward was waiting at the employment office in Santa Monica. He had some interesting information, but he needed a warrant and clearance with the Santa Monica police to make an arrest. Moreno listened to the story and forgot his bongo troubles.
It was a different kind of trouble that sent him speeding out of Wilshire. Sam was waiting with an address he'd obtained from the office. Inside. What do you use, a crystal ball or seven cents? Moreno demanded. The old man's grandson. Did he tip you in some way? Is there something I missed? Later, Sam answered. I'll write my memoirs. Right now? He shoved the address under Moreno's nose and got in the car. It wasn't far and it wasn't fashionable. It was one of the older two-story apartment buildings on a street of multiple units that faced one another like evenly matched sparring partners divided by two lanes of spasmodic traffic. Inside, an entry hall and a row of mailboxes. Sam's finger ran along the names carefully and finally stopped. Mr. and Mrs. John Schuyler, he read. What do you think? I think you've hit it, Moreno said. Apartment 7B, Sam said. They went up together. Daylight was fading, and the upper hall, still unlighted, was deeply shadowed. They groped their way to the far end of it before finding the right door. Sam listened. Behind the door, the faint sound of jazz came to meet him, a bass viol, a probing trumpet, and the dominating throb of drums. John Schiller was a drummer. Sam listened a moment longer, and Moreno pulled his gun. I don't trust to hit and run, he said. It takes an unbalanced mind to do a thing like that. This character may be a psycho.
His character, Sam said quietly, is a fool. Then he rapped loudly on the door. Schiller? John Schiller. Open the door. The jazz stopped instantly. Schiller? There was another sound, a scrambling sound, as if furniture had gotten someone's way. Okay, Moreno, Sam said. Moreno was an expert on locks. A professional housebreaker couldn't have done the job more quickly, although he would have done it more quietly. One well-placed shot at closed range, and it was only a matter of picking away the splinters. When Sam kicked open the door, Moreno had the room covered. They were none too soon. A tall, dark-haired youth with a frightened face had scrambled as far as the kitchen door before Moreno's command. Backed up by the gun, swung him about, and pinned him against the wall. John Schiller looked more like 16 than 20. He stared at the gun in Moreno's hand.
Don't shoot, he said. I haven't done anything.
Where's the woman? Moreno demanded.
I don't know what you mean.
You know what we mean, Sam said. Where is she, Schiller?
My name is Schuyler, John Schuyler. There's been some mistake.
Where is she? He stopped fighting. She's gone out, he said. Where?
To the store for groceries.
When?
Not long ago. 10-15 minutes.
Did you take the car?
Yeah, sure.
Better get downstairs, Moreno, Sam said. She may spot the police car when she comes back. Don't worry about Johnny. He isn't going anywhere. Sam opened his coat to reach for a handkerchief in his back pocket. He wore his service revolver and a shoulder holster. It looked ominous enough to keep John Schiller pinned to the wall even after Moreno had gone. Sit down, Sam ordered. Obediently, Schiller moved to the nearest chair and perched nervously on the edge of a seat. Are you happy, Johnny? Sam asked. The question wasn't expected, and Schiller stared at him. What? He said. You've had nearly 6 months of it. Are you still happy?
I don't dig you, the boy began.
You dig me, all right. You're not married, are you?
Not yet. Her divorce isn't final.
Then clear out. Schiller half rose from the chair.
Now wait a minute.
No, you wait and you listen, Sam said. Don't try to be noble. Because you're not. You're a silly kid who fell for the flattering attentions of an older woman. But it's not love, Johnny. Not yours and not hers.
I do love Sandy, Schiller protested.
You loathe her, Sam said. If it hasn't hit you yet, it will. One of these mornings you'll wake up and go into the bathroom and throw up what's left of your big love affair and then you'll clear out, Johnny. That's exactly what you'll do, unless you're fool enough to wait around for that divorce. He was hitting home hard. He knew that Schiller didn't want to face the truth. But she's down on her luck just now. I can't walk out when she's down on her luck. And why not? Have you got a broken leg? Stop trying to be a hero, Johnny. You're out of uniform. Sandy Downs is a grown woman. Her luck is what she made it with her big blue eyes wide open. Yours aren't quite open yet, or are they beginning to see the light? The rest of your life, Johnny. That's all you have at stake. The rest of your life. The lecture ended when Moreno walked in with Sandy Downs. He'd intercepted her in the driveway, and she wasn't happy. What is all this? She demanded. What is all this about an accident, Johnny? Does it make any sense to you? Moreno wasn't happy either. Sam, he said, the gray Buick is down in the driveway, but there's not the slightest indication of it ever hitting Kathy Lambert. I know, Sam said, it didn't. While Moreno looked incredulous, Sam explained it to him. We're taking Schiller and the woman in on Max Schiller's old complaint, missing persons. Kathy Lambert was struck down by someone driving an Impala convertible, light blue. Kathy Lambert regained consciousness a little after 6 p.m. She was young and healthy. She could absorb a lot of punishment and still survive. An hour later, a man who couldn't get along with his conscience saved the police a lot of work by turning himself in. He had been upset about his failing marriage and careless in his driving. The proof of his confession was written on the right front fender of his light blue Impala convertible. No crystal ball and no 7 cents, Sam explained to Moreno and Captain Norton. Just common sense. Who knows more about the different makes and models of cars than any expert in the world? My 10-year-old son, Moreno admitted. Exactly. A kid can recognize the make and model of any automobile a block away. An accident like that doesn't mean to a child what it meant to Mrs. Grossman, for instance. She's a mother. She probably never saw the car. Her only thought was for the child. Max Schiller, on the other hand, is an old man with an obsession. He'd been sitting on his front porch for the past 6 months with only one thing on his mind, the return of his grandson. How could his grandson return? In a gray Buick sedan, Captain Norton suggested. Well, that was my hunch. The old man must have seen John Schiller and Sandy Downs together in that car. We know he'd seen them together somewhere because of the mention of her in the missing persons report. But there is no more reason to think that he could recognize the make and model of the collision car in the midst of that emotional crisis than Mrs. Grossman could. Less reason, perhaps. I doubt if Max Schiller ever owned a car. And yet he gave a positive identification not only of the car but of the driver. I couldn't buy that, Captain. I couldn't believe that old Max Schiller had seen what he claimed to have seen, at least not with his eyes. Not with his eyes, Norton echoed. With his mind, Sam explained. In his mind, Captain, his grandson was a killer of children when he ran off with that woman. His own children. Not only a crystal ball, Moreno remarked, an analyst as well. Sam shook his head. No crystal ball and no analyst, just files. I ran across the Schiller case in the unsolved files just before the captain ordered me out of the office. Something about it stuck in my mind. When we came across that accident and one of the witnesses had the same name, I just had to follow my hunch. And then Sam Ward, who never stopped working and never relaxed, gave them one of his rare, sad smiles. After all, as the captain said, it was my day off. It was late when Sam left for home, but he didn't stop to eat on the way. Dixie would have supper warm and ready, no matter how late he came in, and she would be eagerly waiting to hear what important case Captain Norton had needed him for this time. He always had to have a good story for Dixie. Tonight he was lucky. Kathy Lambert had made the front pages. Some of the story he left out, some of the details about John Schiller and the woman he'd gone off with. "And you found the poor old man's grandson and sent him home?" Dixie exclaimed. "Sammy, aren't you proud of yourself?" Sam Ward cringed inside every time his wife called him Sammy. 17 years ago, when they had eloped to Las Vegas, it had been a term of endearment. But 17 years ago, Sam had only been 19 and Dixie only 33. She wasn't exciting or glamorous anymore. She was only a ridiculous woman with the over-pampered face of a rapidly aging child. "What will they do to the man who confessed?" she demanded. She didn't really care. It was only a game they played, a pretense that there was something of interest left between them. "The rest of his life," Sam said sadly. "The rest of his life? Do you mean he'll get life for an accident that wasn't even fatal?" For a moment, Sam had difficulty remembering who Dixie was talking about. He'd had only one thing on his mind from the time he found the missing person report in the unsolved file. "No, of course not," he said. "I was thinking of another case. Another case entirely." That was Helen Nielsen. Cops Day Off. Helen Nielsen was born in Roseville, Illinois on October 23, 1918, and studied journalism, art, and aeronautical drafting at various schools, including the Chicago Art Institute. Before her writing career, she worked as a draftsman during World War II and contributed to the designs of various aircraft. She wrote 18 novels and nearly 50 short stories, mostly for Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Also writing scripts for such TV dramas as Perry Mason and Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Her stories were often set in Laguna Beach and Oceanside, California, where she lived for 60 years before retiring to Arizona, passing away in Prescott on June 22, 2002. The back jacket on the Chester Himes book, the first guy I read said, "Spanning over 40 years of Chester Himes' writing career, this provocative collection of short stories uncovers the internal struggles of black individuals caught between rage and resignation in American society. From the earliest stories written at the time of Himes' term in prison for jewelry theft, to those written after his emigration to France and later Spain, where he died in 1984, these tales resound with wit and indignation. This collection includes all of Himes' surviving stories, including some never published before, and is the first original book to be released in the U.S. in over a decade by one of the 20th century's most compelling writers." There you have it, another beautiful episode of Good Night, Norman. I say again, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, happy